Hello everyone, I would like to welcome you to our 2013-2014 Legal Issues webinar series, part of the ADA National Network's ADA Online Learning Program on Legal Issues. Just going to take you through some logistic information for today's session before I pass it along to our speakers, who have a lot of great content to get covered. So for listening to the webinar, the audio is coming through your computer in the webinar room, so make sure that your speakers are turned on or your headphones are plugged in. We do have an audio and video panel in the top left corner of your screen. You can adjust your audio by sliding the sound bar left or right to your preference. And if you're having any kind of quality problem with your audio, you can click on the audio wizard, which is accessed using the blue microphone icon with the red starburst in the top right corner of that audio and video panel, and that will allow you to configure your computer speakers to make the sound better for you. If you don't have sound capabilities on your computer or if the telephone is your preference, we do have a telephone option available. It is not a toll-free number, but it is an option at area code 712-432-3066, and you'll have to use passcode 148937. For our mobile users, you are able to access today's session using a variety of mobile devices, including iPhones, iPads, Androids, and Kindles. So you can download the Blackboard Collaborate mobile app from your respective app store to listen to the session using a mobile device. We do want to point out that closed captioning is not available in the mobile app, and it also has limited accessibility for screen reader or voiceover users. We do offer captioning in our webinar room, so we are providing real-time captioning at this time. You can access the captioning screen by choosing the blue CC icon in the top right corner of that audio and video panel. Once you've selected to turn that on, you can resize that captioning window to your preference. You can change the font size and also save a transcript of that captioning. If you have questions, with a lot of great content, we always hope that you have questions to present to us. So you can type and submit your questions in the chat area text box, or you can press Control M and enter text in the chat area that way. If you are using a mobile device, you can submit questions in the chat area within your app. And if you're listening by phone or you're not logged into the actual webinar platform, you can always email us those questions at webinars@ada-audio.org. I would like to point out that we are recording this webinar, and it will be available on our ADA Online Learning website at ada-audio.org, usually in about 24 hours after the conclusion of our session. To customize your view of the slides that we're going through, you can use the Fit page option that's in the top middle of your screen, and then you can make that larger or smaller depending on your preference. You can also resize and reposition the chat, participant, and audio and video panels on the left side of your screen by using the icon in the top right corner of each of those with all the little lines and the little triangle. That will allow you to detach those panels. If you require any kind of technical assistance, we are here to support you. So you can double-click on the Great Lakes ADA participant name in the participant list. It will open up a tab in your chat panel, and you can go ahead and send a private chat message to us. We will respond to that with your technical assistance answers. You can also use keyboard F6 for that, and then arrow up and down to locate Great Lakes ADA and select to send a message. You can also email us at webinars@ada-audio.org, or you can call our toll-free line for tech support at 877-232-1990. So with all of that completed, I would like to pass this along to Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg, both from Equip for Equality, and they are going to talk to you about the top ADA cases of 2013.
Great. Thanks, Jessica, and Happy New Year, everybody. This is Barry Taylor. I'm going to start, and then Rachel will join us. We're so glad to have so many of you joining us today and hope that you will find this presentation helpful. We are, Equip for Quality is a certified continuing legal education provider for attorneys in Illinois. So if you are an attorney in Illinois and you are interested in obtaining credit for this session, you can email me after the session is over at barryt@equipforequality.org, and then we'll follow up with you with all the paperwork. So, of course, we can't cover all the major ADA cases that happened in 2013, so what we tried to do is choose some significant ones that we think raise important themes, and several of these were decided just within the last month or two. So even you ADA experts out there may find some cases you haven't even heard of yet, so we hope that these are helpful to you. What we're going to do first is start with the Title I cases for employment, and I'm going to take the first three, the first one looking at the ADA Amendments Act interpretation, the next two looking at the issue of qualified, and then I'm going to turn it over to Rachel, and she's going to talk about three reasonable accommodation cases and also a medical examination case that came up. At that point, we'll open it up for questions, see if anybody has questions about the employment cases. And once we get through those, we'll then turn to the rest of the ADA cases. I will talk about three different Title II cases covering state and local government services. And then I'll turn it over to Rachel, who will cover three cases under Title III, which covers public accommodations, which are public or private businesses open to the public. Once we've gone through those cases, we're going to give you some updates from cases we highlighted in our webinar last year. If you remember last January, we talked about the top 12 ADA cases of 2012. Well, three of them have had some significant developments in 2013, so we wanted to give you some updates on those cases so that you're completely up to date. After we go through those, we will open it up again for questions for not only Title II and Title III, but any questions you have about the issues we've raised today. And if we have a time at the end after that, there are a couple of Supreme Court cases that were decided that aren't ADA cases, but they were decided in 2013 and could have impact on ADA cases in the future. So let's start first with the Title I cases looking at employment. And as I mentioned, I'm going to be talking first about the ADA Amendments Act interpretation for our first case. You know, January 1st was the fifth anniversary of the effective date of the ADA Amendments Act. It's hard to believe it's been 5 years since it's been effective. And we've seen numerous ADA cases at the trial court level, but very few at the appellate court level. And just last month in December, we had a significant appellate court decision right here in the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. And it's one that was very encouraging for people with disabilities, so we certainly wanted to include this as part of our session today. So this case is called Gogos versus AMS Mechanical Systems. And in that case, we had the plaintiff, the employee, he worked as a pipe welder for 45 years, so a long-time employee, and he had had high blood pressure for over 8 years, and it was controlled by medication. But he did experience some problems related to his blood pressure. His blood pressure spiked to very high, and he also experienced some short-term vision loss. His supervisor granted his request to leave to get immediate medical treatment because he came to work and his eye was red and he was having a hard time with his vision. Clearly something was going on. So on his way out, he told the general foreman that he would be going to the hospital because of his health issues, and the foreman fired the plaintiff right on the spot. Well, the plaintiff ended up filing in district court, and the district court dismissed the case. They found that his disabilities were not covered by the ADA because they were transitory and suspect. And because his case wasn't covered by the ADA, it was dismissed. So then the case went up on appeal to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit found for the plaintiff. And as I mentioned, this is one of the first appellate court decisions that is substantively applying the ADA Amendments Act. And this case is really helpful, I think. If you get a chance to read it, I think it's a really good tool not only to understand this case, but it also talks about different parts of the ADA Amendments Act and how it is being applied. So one of the things that the court looked at is the issue of episodic conditions. And for those of you who don't remember, before the ADA Amendments Act, many impairments that people had were found not to be ADA disabilities because they were episodic or intermittent. And Congress, when they passed the ADA Amendments Act, which sought to really bring back some of Congress's original intent, said, look, we want episodics to be covered. You just need to show that episodics conditions are covered by the ADA if you can show that they would be substantially limiting when active. And so that's exactly what happened here in this case. The defendant, the employer, said that it shouldn't be covered by the ADA, it's episodic, it's not a disability, and the court said yes. Even if the plaintiff's blood pressure spike and vision loss were episodic, meaning it wasn't happening all the time, those can still be disabilities. And the court noted that the EEOC lists hypertension as an example of an impairment that can be episodic. And as a side note, I want to note that the fact that the court looked at the EEOC's list is also significant, because you remember when the ADA Amendments Act was passed, one of the reasons why they needed to pass that law was because courts were not looking at the EEOC's interpretation of the definition of disability. The Supreme Court had found that the EEOC didn't have that authority. And so when Congress passed the ADA Amendments Act, they said, no, courts, you got it wrong. We want the EEOC to interpret not only the substantive employment provisions, but also the definition of disability. So this is a good example of showing that now courts will look to the EEOC. The EEOC put together a list of types of impairments that they think would be episodic that could be covered by the ADA, and here we see a court deferring to the EEOC. The defendant had said that because it's a short-term impairment, it can't be a disability, and again, the court here relied upon the EEOC's regs, the appendix to their regs, which talks specifically about the fact that periods during which an episodic impairment is active and substantially limits a major life activity may be brief or incur infrequently is no longer relevant to determining whether the impairment substantially limits a major life activity. Another sort of key point of the ADA Amendments Act was that some impairments were having a hard time meeting the definition of disability in that they couldn't show that a major life activity was substantially limited. And so one of the things we saw in the ADA Amendments Act is they expanded the definition of major life activity to also include something called major bodily functions. And one of those bodily functions they identified was the circulatory function. So what the plaintiff alleged here was he was limited in the major life activity of eyesight, but also circulatory function. And the court easily accepted the fact that now they look expansively at major life activities, including major bodily functions like a circulatory function. It might have been a different outcome if this case had been filed before the ADA Amendments Act because of that. So that's another key change that we're seeing applied in courts. Another key change to remember is that before the ADA Amendments Act, the Supreme Court had held that if you use a mitigating measure, like medication or an assistive device, to address the manifestations of your disability, that mitigating measure has to be taken into account when determining whether somebody is substantially limited in a major life activity. And Congress said, no, courts, again, you got it wrong. We no longer want courts to look at that issue when determining whether somebody is substantially limited. You can look at the mitigating measure when determining whether they're qualified to do the job, but when you're figuring out whether they're covered by the ADA itself, we don't want you to consider mitigating measures. Here, we had a case where the plaintiff used a mitigating measure, a blood pressure medicine. Again, if before the ADA Amendments Act this case had been brought, the plaintiff likely would have lost because they would have taken the medication into account, may not have been deemed substantially limited. But here the court follows Congress's directive and says we must disregard the ameliorative effects of mitigating measures like medication. And once again, we see the court relying upon the EEOC regulations, which has language that's actually directly on point and says that somebody who takes medication for hypertension and would have had substantial limitations to cardiovascular and circulatory system without medication is covered by the law. So again, we see tremendous deference to the EEOC in ruling for the plaintiff here. Now remember, you not only have to show you have a disability under the ADA, you also have to show you're qualified to do the job and that you were there was an adverse action because of your disability, and the plaintiff was able to prove that as well. So as a result, the court vacated the dismissal of the lower court and sent the case back below. Interestingly, this is a case involving a pro se plaintiff. He didn't have an attorney, and he filed a one-page complaint, and it's that one-page complaint that went all the way up the Seventh Circuit and established some really important principles. For those of you who really want to get more information about the ADA Amendments Act, we've listed a few sources here that go into it a little bit more deep. One is our legal brief that we did in September that analyzed a lot more cases on the ADA Amendments Act. There's also a publication put out by the National Council on Disability, and also a study done by the University of Minnesota that might be of interest. Now that the ADA Amendments Act has made it easier to prove disability, the legal battleground is really shifting to whether somebody is qualified. And remember, qualified means you have to show you can perform the essential functions of the job with or without a reasonable accommodation. And the issue of qualified is going to be the subject for the legal webinar we're doing in May, but today we wanted to just highlight two recent cases focusing on qualified, on the specific issues of qualified regarding attendance and punctuality. Now, the general rule that we've seen with most courts is they have found that attendance and punctuality are essential functions and therefore don't need to be accommodated. However, these two cases we're going to show today indicate that there may be more courts that are taking a more flexible position when it comes to this issue. So the first case we're going to talk about is the McMillan case out of New York. And in this case, the plaintiff was a case manager and had job duties of conducting home visits, processing social assessments, that sort of thing, was not a manager, did not manage people. And the city had a flex time policy. Employees could actually arrive up until 10:15 before they were considered late. Now the plaintiff here had schizophrenia and took medication that made him drowsy and sluggish in the morning, which made it really hard for him to arrive on time, and oftentimes he was arriving after 11 o'clock. For about 10 years, though, the city allowed that to happen and didn't have a problem with it. But in 2008, they stopped saying late arrivals were okay, and they suspended him. He was terminated, or recommended for termination, but because of a union grievance, he was only suspended. And so he formally asked for some accommodations to allow him to start later and work later because of his disability. This case went up to the district court, and they found that arriving at work within a one-hour time frame is an essential function of the job, and so they found for the employer here. They were very deferential to the employer judgment that punctuality was an essential function, and they said, you know, if you look at it, most jobs require timeliness, and so we think that's necessary here, and we're not going to allow the plaintiff to win here. Then the case got appealed up to the Second Circuit, and they said, wait a second, we think this is a question of fact, and they found for the employee. And they said that the timely arrival at work may generally be an essential function. They agreed to that general principle, but they said courts still have to conduct a fact-specific inquiry. They can't just take for granted that it's a essential function for every job. And they said, look, first of all, the plaintiff had worked many years with late arrivals, and the city had either implicitly or explicitly approved this. So if it was essential, you know, he was doing it for 10 years and without, you know, any difficulties. So that undercut their argument. And also the city had a flex time policy which permitted employees to arrive and leave within a one-hour window, which suggested that punctuality wasn't necessarily an essential function. The court distinguished cases that the employer raised about timeliness being essential and said, yeah, we agree that there's some jobs that do require punctuality, like ones that are required presence for specific hours, or if the employee's a supervisor, or there are certain deadlines that have to be met. But they said that this case didn't necessarily raise those issues, especially since he had been working with this modified schedule for so many years. And they also found that the plaintiff's accommodation could be reasonable for him to work late. The defendant was concerned about him working unsupervised after 6 o'clock, but you know, working unsupervised isn't that different from a request to work from home or some of the home visits he did for his work. And he had worked unsupervised in other settings without a problem. And the fact that they'd allow employees to bank hours and apply them to later arrivals already also sort of undercut their argument. Interestingly, you haven't heard me say that whether or not he had a disability was not something that even came up. You know, again, I think this shows how different things have gone with the ADA Amendments Act in that we're not seeing the challenges of disability that we saw in other situations. And again, because he took medication for his disability, he might not have been able to win. But here, because of the ADA Amendments Act, it wasn't even challenged in the decision. So the query is whether the future of timeliness as essential job function, what does this mean in the world of telework and flex time? And so as flexibility increases generally, we may be seeing more arguments accepted that punctuality is not an essential function. Also, just real quickly, the court distinguished between absenteeism and tardiness, saying that an absent employee doesn't complete the work, but a late employee who makes up the time does. And then the last case I'm going to talk about and then turn it over to Rachel is EEOC versus AT&T Corporation, another qualified case. This case had a plaintiff with hepatitis C. He had missed work to get treatment for his hepatitis C. When he missed some work, he received a written warning that said, attendance is an essential function of your job. Satisfactory attendance is a condition of your employment. He had worked there for over 25 years, and so he was eligible to up to 52 weeks of short-term disability with full pay. So even after he got that written warning, he elected to take 4 months of leave using his short-term disability and his Family Medical Leave Act leave, and then sought to return to work in October. And once she arrived back to work, she was terminated for excessive absences. One interesting fact, or important fact, is that while she was off on leave, AT&T did not hire anyone to fill in for her or require other employees to work overtime. So the issue here was she a qualified employee, and is attendance an essential function of her employment? Again, you know, I'm not saying one of the issues was whether she had a disability or not. It wasn't disputed, at least as laid out in the court decision that were given. Again, shows the impact of the ADA Amendments Act. I mean, some pre-ADA Amendments Act cases had found hepatitis C was not a disability, not even disputed, at least in this court ruling here. So the EEOC argued that because AT&T had all kinds of different types of leave of absence plans and the fact that the job description was silent as to whether attendance was an essential function meant that attendance shouldn't be considered an essential function here, and she should have been able to take the leave she had sought. AT&T turned around and said, well, what about the written warning and the manager's testimony said that attendance was an essential function? EEOC says that you're supposed to defer to the employer's view of what's considered essential. But remember, that's only one factor. So what the court said was, you know, we can't really determine at this stage whether it is an essential function or not. It's an issue of fact, whether the leave requested was something that she was entitled to and whether it would create an undue hardship. And one thing I think that's important about this case is it sort of opens another door, and that is that we're going to see more cases looking at what is undue hardship. It's an important defense that defendants can raise if they think an accommodation is not reasonable, but we have relatively little case law because so many cases have been defeated because of the lack of being able to show you had a disability. Now, with the ADA Amendments Act, we're going to see more cases on qualified and more cases on undue hardship. Again, I think it's going to be a hard undue hardship claim here because AT&T did not hire anybody to fill in while she was gone or require other employees to work overtime. Also, AT&T is a very large employer, and the position she had was sort of a fungible position that did not require expertise of an individual that could be covered by other people. So, remember, these two cases we showed are not necessarily the majority view, but perhaps are indicating a change of perspective with respect to attendance and punctuality. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rachel to talk about reasonable accommodation.
Thanks, Barry, and hello to everyone, and Happy New Year. Our next case is a great reminder of the breadth of reasonable accommodations. This case is Feist versus Louisiana Department of Justice, which came from the Fifth Circuit. So in Feist, the case was brought by an attorney with osteoarthritis who requested, as a reasonable accommodation, a free on-site parking space. And at the district court level, the court found against the employee and held that the employee failed to connect her accommodation request to an essential function of her job. So really, in other words, it held that legally an accommodation must have a nexus to an employee's essential job functions. And the plaintiff appealed, so the question before the appellate court was, can something be a reasonable accommodation if it does not enable the employee to perform her essential job functions? And the plaintiff argued, yes, it can. And once I got to the Fifth Circuit agreed. It interpreted the definition of reasonable accommodation to be broad and did not require a link to an essential job function. So let's look at how the Fifth Circuit reached its decision. It started with the language of the ADA itself and emphasized that Congress said reasonable accommodations may include making existing facilities readily accessible to and usable by individuals with disabilities. And the court explained the provision of a parking spot could be one way to make a facility accessible. After looking at the statute, the Fifth Circuit turned to the EEOC regulations, which explain that reasonable accommodations enable individuals with disabilities to do one of three things. One, complete a job application or participate in the application process. Two, perform the essential functions of their job. And three, enjoy the equal benefits and privileges of employment. And the Fifth Circuit also pointed out that the appendix to the EEOC regulations specifically state that a reserved parking space may be a reasonable accommodation. So this case was ultimately sent back to the district court to determine whether the parking space was reasonable in this case. So we wanted to highlight this case because we so often focus on accommodations that are tied to essential job functions, but it's important to remember that there's so many other potential accommodations out there. And this case confirms that accommodations for things like employer training or participating in employer-provided services, such as maybe an employee gym or employee transportation, and employer-sponsored events such as parties and other functions, office functions, would also be things that an employee could seek reasonable accommodations for. And just as Barry explained before, it was great to see in this case that the Fifth Circuit did so much, was very deferential to the EEOC regulations, and even deferring to the appendix to the EEOC regulations. And we have a query on the bottom of the slide that asks, what are the potential implications of this case? And one idea that we had is that there have been a number of cases discussing whether an employer has to accommodate an employee's commute. And some legal analysts believe that this case helps bring plaintiffs one step further to be able to argue that commuting is something that should be accommodated. So our next two cases examine the interactive process. And as a reminder, under the ADA, after an employee requests a reasonable accommodation, an employer is supposed to engage in the interactive process to see if that specific request is reasonable, and if not, to determine if there are any other accommodations that could be effective. We think the following two cases are helpful examples of how courts examine the interactive process. So starting with the Seventh Circuit case, Bazin versus Professional Transportation, Inc. In this case, the plaintiff worked as a dispatcher for a company that provided ground transportation service for railroads. All employees who worked for Bazin were subject to an attendance policy, and the plaintiff in this case had missed work on a number of occasions, and she had various medical appointments and was ultimately diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And per the attendance policy, Bazin gave her some written warnings and suspensions, and she ended up requesting a leave of absence for 30 days as a reasonable accommodation. So remember, the request that she made triggered the employer's obligation to engage in the interactive process. Here, however, the employer did not engage in the interactive process. It simply denied her. It denied the plaintiff's request for leave, and it terminated her. So the employee brought an ADA lawsuit alleging that she was wrongfully terminated and that her request for reasonable accommodations were unlawfully denied. So let's look at what happened. Starting with the district court found for the employer, and the Seventh Circuit affirmed this decision. Let's discuss why, starting with the plaintiff's claim of wrongful termination. So the Seventh Circuit noted, just as Barry explained earlier, that employers are generally permitted to treat attendance as an essential job function. And here, the court found that the plaintiff was not able to attend work and therefore was not qualified. That is, the court found that even if she had received the leave, the plaintiff failed to present evidence that she would have been able to perform her job and to attend work. And the court looked at what the testimony was, and the plaintiff had testified that she hoped she could return after her leave, and she had provided testimony from her doctor saying that there was a good chance that she could return, but the court found that this was insufficient for her to be qualified. And again, because the ADA protects qualified individuals with a disability, the plaintiff was not qualified. The court found that the plaintiff's termination did not violate the ADA. Next, the court turned to the plaintiff's claim for failure to accommodate. Again, it was undisputed that the plaintiff's claim, it was undisputed that the employer did not engage in the interactive process. However, the court found that the employer did not violate the ADA. So why not? Well, the court noted that failing to engage in the interactive process is not an independent basis for liability. And if the employer is not qualified for the job and doesn't present evidence that an accommodation existed that would have made her qualified for the job, then there's no violation. And here, as we just discussed, the employee failed to establish that she was qualified, and thus the employer didn't violate the ADA by failing to engage in the interactive process. So why is this case important? Well, there are a few reasons. First, generally, if there is proof that an employer fails to engage in an interactive process, courts will generally deny motions for summary judgment on a failure to accommodate claim. And this is a real motivation for employers to engage in the process. But here, the Seventh Circuit scaled this general rule back a bit, finding that that's not the case if the plaintiff could show that an effective, reasonable accommodation would not have resulted from the interactive process. Second, while we review cases to learn from them, employers really should proceed with caution before mirroring the exact actions found in this case. The employer's actions here were risky. One reason for that is that the interactive process is the opportunity for parties to sit down and find a solution that might not otherwise have been obvious. And many employers who do not engage in the interactive process will miss the chance to identify a potential reasonable accommodation and will not have the same result as the defendant did here. So it is a best practice and the law to engage in that interactive process. The second case that we wanted to talk about the interactive process is Huner versus Arlington School District, which is a district court case from South Dakota. And this shows a different approach to the interactive process. In Huner, the plaintiff was an art teacher, and she had anxiety. She requested a number of different accommodations, including the accommodation of reducing her course load. Specifically, she asked that one class, this class called Credit Recovery, be removed from her course load until she was able to stabilize her symptoms. The district court responded by granting some of Huner's requests and denying others. What does the interactive process look like? It differs in different situations, but here the employer opted not to sit down for a face-to-face discussion and instead continue to respond to the plaintiff's request just by sending letters. And in total, the school district sent the plaintiff 3 different letters. But a few days after receiving the 3rd of these letters, the plaintiff learned that the principal had recommended that the school district not renew her contract. And so the plaintiff ended up filing an ADA claim, and the school district moved for summary judgment. So during the course of this litigation, both parties alleged that the other party was the one that caused the breakdown of the interactive process. The plaintiff said, hey, school district, you're the one who failed to engage in this interactive process because you never met with me in person, and you really didn't take my request seriously. And on the other side of the coin, the school district said, no, it was actually the plaintiff who failed to engage in the interactive process. The plaintiff never responded to our 3rd letter, so what were we going to do? How are we going to move forward? And the court took a look at all these facts and said, and the court actually found for the plaintiff and allowed the plaintiff's case to move forward. What the court said is that it was not the plaintiff that broke down the interactive process, because if you looked at all the facts here, a jury could find that the school district was not acting in good faith, because the school district in the middle of the process had actually recommended that the teacher's contract not be renewed. And the court said that a jury could find that the plaintiff's further participation in the interactive process would have been useless, given the fact that the school district wasn't acting in good faith. The court also criticized the school district for failing to meet with the teacher face-to-face to discuss her accommodations. So as you can see here, unlike in Basden, there was a potential reasonable and effective accommodation that would have resulted had the parties engaged in this interactive process, and that was the removal of this credit recovery class. And so because of that, the court denied the employer's motion for summary judgment. So one tip that we have here for plaintiffs, employees in pursuing Title I cases is that it's always important to identify the accommodation that was requested or the accommodation that would have resulted from the interactive process. And just as we warned employers when we were discussing the Basden case, here we really want to warn employees not to necessarily follow in this plaintiff's footsteps. Yes, here the court concluded that a reasonable jury could find that the plaintiffs engaging in the interactive process would have been futile and useless, but that doesn't always happen. And remember, both sides have obligations to engage in the interactive process. So we encourage all parties, employees and employers, to engage in the interactive process in good faith, even if the other side isn't, as the court found to be happening here. So this case is moving forward. There's not a final decision yet, but a jury trial is scheduled in this case for April 2014. So we'll stay tuned to see if the plaintiff's ultimately able to prove her claims. Our final case under Title I is this case EEOC versus Beverage Distributors Company, and this is a case about medical exams and inquiries. Now, as a reminder, the ADA regulates when an employer can require medical exams, and it divides these rules into three different categories. There's the application, the conditional job offer, and the rules for current employees. But what we're going to talk about here is the rules for conditional job offers. And the reason for that is that the employee was given a conditional job offer for a new position. So those are the relevant rules, the conditional job offer rules. So under the ADA, after extending a conditional job offer, employers can require a medical exam so long as this is done for all incoming employees. But of course, employers cannot use the information gleaned from this exam in a way that would violate the ADA. So with that context, what happened here is we have a plaintiff who is legally blind and for over 4 years worked as a driver's helper. However, his position was eliminated, and so the employee applied for a new position as a night warehouse loader, where he would be responsible for things like loading cases of liquor and kegs into trucks. So what happened is the company gave the employee a conditional job offer contingent on the results of a pre-employment medical exam. The employee took the medical exam, and after, the company withdrew the employee's job offer, explaining that due to the employee's eyesight, he was unable to safely perform the job. As we were just discussing, the rules here are going to be the rules for conditional job offers. And as we have on slide 34, employers can ask disability-related questions during this time, so long as it's done uniformly. In this case, the EEOC, what's interesting is that many cases involving medical exams actually challenge the legality of the test itself. But here, the EEOC didn't challenge the medical exam in and of itself. What it did is it challenged the way that the employer used the results of the medical exam. So that's one reason we wanted to talk about this case today, is it's a good reminder of that aspect of the law that we don't frequently see. So what happened is in April of 2003, after a four-day jury trial, the jury found for the employee and found that the employer intentionally violated the ADA. Or in other words, the jury agreed that with the EEOC that the employer used the results of this medical exam unlawfully. And as a result, the jury awarded the employee over $130,000 in back pay, but ultimately found that the employee failed to mitigate its damages and so reduced the back pay award. So another thing that happened in this case in 2013 happened just last month, and that is the district court vacated the jury award and issued a number of really strong findings. One, it awarded the employee all of his back pay. The court stated that the company failed to identify comparable jobs that the employee could have performed, and because of this, the employee was entitled to his full back pay award. Second, the court awarded interest on back pay. Third, the court ordered injunctive relief, specifically that the defendant hire the employee to the position of a night warehouse loader with the same seniority and salary that he would have received but for the discrimination. And finally, the court ordered the defendant to hire an outside consultant to provide employee training and to revise a number of its employee policies and postings. So for more information about this case, we have a link to the EEOC press release on the bottom of this slide, slide 35. And with that, that brings us to the conclusion of our discussion of Title I cases, and I think we're going to open the floor for a few minutes for questions.
So people can type in the chat box. I don't see any questions yet, but if you have questions on these cases, you can type something in the chat box. And we'll be happy to answer them.
Barry, I actually do see one question that I think is going to your to one of your cases. So I'll read it, and then either of us can answer it. But the question is, I was wondering if the case that allowed lateness would consider considered an accommodation to come in earlier, which is the reverse accommodation.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
So
he
I
could.
Guess the question is.
Sorry. Go ahead.
So go ahead, Barry.
I was just going to say, just based on what you read, I mean, certainly when we're talking about accommodations and flexible schedule, that's what's anticipated is providing flexibility in the workplace. So letting somebody come in earlier if that works for their disability or letting somebody come in later could be an accommodation. For this particular person, mornings were really hard because of the medication made him really drowsy. So I don't think coming in earlier would have helped him. And if the company had countered and said, that's what we're going to offer you, I don't think that would have been sort of a reasonable process in the interactive process because that actually went against what was going on with his disability. Did you have any other thoughts?
And just to follow up on that, I think coming in early could possibly be an accommodation for someone with a different disability who had a different limitation. Just, you know, off the top of my head, maybe they had a limitation or the medication made them drowsy at night, and so they wanted to shift their whole schedule up to start earlier and end earlier. And I think for the same rationale that Barry explained in that decision, starting early and ending early could potentially be a reasonable accommodation if, you know, the facts warranted it, unlike the case here where the individual needed to start late.
Great. I don't see any other questions. Do you, Rachel?
I do. It's actually, it's in the moderator conversation
box. Oh, I
see.
Okay. Sorry, I missed all those.
Sure. So question number two says, interesting cases. We are curious as a group, what happens to these individuals after final ruling? Are they awarded money? And I guess the answer to that really differs based on the case. Under Title I of the ADA, individuals are entitled to various different types of remedies should they be able to prove their case. One remedy is back pay, meaning they're able to receive the payment that they would have received at the time of their termination up until the point of their recovery. A lot of employees are also able to obtain injunctive relief, meaning they either want to be awarded the accommodation or to be awarded the job, to actually be able to receive the job that they were looking for. So those are a couple of the remedies that are available under Title I of the ADA.
And the other thing I would just mention is that sometimes, sure, the other thing I would mention is that sometimes the cases are just money isn't awarded because the case isn't over yet. What the plaintiff has done is survive summary judgment, meaning the case isn't over, but it's not going to be dismissed, and it's going to go forward with trial. And so a lot of times the plaintiff's win isn't necessarily the end of the case. It just means that the case can proceed, as in some of the ones we gave. And it looks like the next two questions are both on your cases, Rachel, if you want to take those.
Sure. So the next question says, can you explain how the company used the results of the medical exam unlawfully? And yeah, that's a great question. And what happened, we're talking about the EEOC versus beverage distributors case, and the employer used the results unlawfully because they said because of this individual's eyesight, he wasn't going to be able to safely perform the job. And so the employer brought in this defense of direct threat, saying that the employee, if he was to move forward with this job would be a direct threat to his health and safety or that of others. And that question actually went to the court, and the court found that no, the employer wasn't able to show the very high standard of direct threat, to be able to show a direct threat, you need to show it's a pretty high standard, and the employer wasn't able to show that, in fact, the employee would have actually been a threat if he was to obtain that job position. And let's see. The next question says, can you please further explain in slide 26 regarding the Fifth Circuit's court decision? So let's see, 26. I'm just going to scroll back here for everyone. Actually, slide 26. So the question here was about the Feist case, which is the case where an individual requested a free on-site parking space to accommodate her disability. So I guess the question is explaining that case a little bit further. The question in Feist was whether or not someone can receive a reasonable accommodation for something other than an essential job function. And the district court had found you needed to link the reasonable accommodation request to an essential job function. And the Fifth Circuit's decision said that no, there doesn't need to be any sort of link to an essential job function. There doesn't need to be any nexus to an essential job function. And the reason why is that there's all of these other ways out there, both under the ADA and under the EEOC regulations. There's other reasons that one would request a reasonable accommodation other than to be able to perform their essential job functions. And those are the things that we discussed when we got to slide 27, like to be able to enjoy equal benefits and privileges of employment and to be able to participate in job applications. And so when the district court required a nexus, they had made an error of law, and they had said they had defined the definition of reasonable accommodation too narrowly. Barry, any other thoughts on that one?
Sounds good.
Okay, we have a number of other questions, but Barry, I'll leave it to you whether you think we should continue on to Title II or handle a couple more.
Yeah, I think one of the questions was a duplicate. It talked about how the medical results were used illegally in the Beveridge case, and I think you explained that. And then there's some questions about that case as well, the Beveridge's case. Why don't we hold those off? You can take a look at those while I talk on the next few slides, Rachel, and then when we open up for questions, then we can answer those two questions and any final questions that people have.
That sounds great. And I'll get us back to Title II.
Great. Thanks, Rachel. And so now we're going to Title II, which are state and local government services. And I'm going to highlight three cases raising really some interesting issues. The first issue we're going to talk about involves the Olmstead case and its interpretation. Remember, the Olmstead case is the Supreme Court decision that said that unjustified isolation of people with disabilities is discrimination. And while that case involved two women who were unable to leave state-run institutions, what we've seen since 1999 when that case was decided is that courts have expanded their interpretation of that case to a lot of other situations, including people who are living at home, who are at risk of institutionalization if they don't get the services they need, as well as people who are not living in state-operated but privately operated state-funded institutions. You might remember, if you were on the webinar last year, Olmstead was expanded even further when we talked about the Lane case, which found that the integration mandate also applied to people in segregated workshops, and that case is still pending. Well, what we've seen is that Lane case has opened the door to more arguments that Olmstead should apply to people who are in segregated employment settings. And the major case that came down in 2013 was a case brought by the U.S. Department of Justice against Rhode Island. And they were doing an investigation regarding the state and the city of Providence unnecessarily segregating individuals in a variety of contexts. One was a segregated program for adults called Training Through Placement, or TTP. It was a placement program that was located in a secluded area in a dilapidated old school. About 90 people spent their days there. doing various activities, but on the average they were paid about $1.57. They were segregated. They were only with other people with disabilities. It was not an integrated situation, even though it was deemed that they could benefit from supported employment and integrated day services. DOJ also investigated a high school program called Birch Vocational Program, which had about 85 students in special ed programs working in a sheltered workshop, doing some of the same types of mundane tasks in exchange for either no wages or subminimum wages. And again, I think the fact that this case goes into kids in school, Olmstead applying to kids in school, is pushing the Olmstead envelope, if you will, even further. And this high school program was actually a direct program or a direct pipeline to the TTP program that was on the previous slide. So you would start in this program and end up in the adult program. Most kids would, and they would not have the opportunity of integrated employment. And again, the students could have qualified for integrated transition services, but they were only getting segregated work options. So DOJ, in its investigation, found that the integration mandate does apply to all programs and services, including day programs, and that state and cities can't administer their policies that steer individuals into these types of facility-based sheltered workshops and away from appropriate integrated alternatives if the individuals qualify for those and don't oppose the latter. So it's not saying that the segregated workshops are impermissible, it's just saying that people who qualify for others should have that opportunity. And so the state and the city entered into an enforceable settlement agreement with DOJ, and DOJ said, we're not finished yet, we're going to do a statewide investigation, but they reached an agreement on these two specific settings, and really the goal was to achieve integration for people who can and want to work, but who've remained unnecessarily in these workshops. And so if you want more information on this interim agreement and all the different things that went along with it, we've got a link there at the bottom of the slide. And just quickly to show you what's going to happen, over the next year, the state and the city have agreed to stop funding or supporting TTP in Birch, and actually Birch is now closed. They agreed to provide career development plans and benefits counseling. They're providing supportive employment services and placement, which would require them to pay at least a minimum wage and be individualized placements rather than everybody being placed in the same place. They're looking for folks to work at least 20 hours a week and have an informed choice to participate where they want to participate. And the whole goal is, in addition to the 20 hours a week of work, they want to have an integrated day services of a total of 40 hours a week, so having a combine of work and non-work activities. It also provides annual career development planning, says that the state should adopt an appropriate employment first policy, which means that integrated employment is the first option, develop a transition planning process for students who are looking to work as they come out of school, ensure that students have the opportunities to graduate with a diploma, which wasn't happening before, develop an education program to inform individuals of choices, and of course DOJ will be monitoring to make sure that the state and the city meet those requirements. Now, I mentioned that that DOJ was doing a statewide investigation. They actually issued letters of finding on January 6th of this month. If you go to DOJ's website, you'll see this. And this findings letter is sort of the precursor to an agreement, and it lays out that they are finding that Rhode Island across the state is violating the ADA by overly relying upon these segregated workshops. And what's interesting here is that Rhode Island is one of the few states that has no state-operated or privately operated institution for people with developmental disabilities and intellectual disabilities. And even though they have no institution, they are still being found by DOJ to be violating the ADA. That's really significant because they're saying you can violate the ADA's integration mandate even if you don't have institutions in your state, which says that integration is more than just about housing. It also includes about how you spend your day, including employment. That letters of finding, Rhode Island will be responding to that, I assume, and I presume some agreement will be worked out, and if it can't be, DOJ could then proceed with litigation. If cities and states are looking to transition to more supported employment, I think the settlement in Rhode Island is a great place for guidance. There's also resources here, the Department of Labor, that might be helpful as well. And then if you go to DOJ's website, they have all the information about the different cases that they've brought, as well as some stories about people who've actually benefited from DOJ's cases that I think are very interesting and really personalize the issue. We've also listed here three Olmstead agreements that you may not have seen that all got decided in reached in the last quarter of 2013. Interesting, all three of them are settlements to address community services for people with mental illness. The one in New Hampshire, they reached an agreement. They'll have a fairness hearing in 2013. Our sister agency in New Hampshire, the Disability Rights Center, worked on that case along with the Center for Public Representation and the Bazelon Center and Department of Justice. And in that agreement, the state of New Hampshire has agreed to expand community mental health services and prevent unnecessary institutionalization. You've got a link to the DOJ website for that. There's also a case out of New York that we've talked about in the past involving people with mental illness living in adult homes, and an agreement has been reached in that case. You've got the Bazelon Center's link there to give you that information. Also, our sister agency in New York worked on that case with Bazelon. They actually had a fairness hearing this month, and fairness hearings are for courts to determine whether the agreement reached is fair and should be approved, and the judge is going to be issuing that decision shortly after hearing that that information from the parties earlier this month. And then you have the T.R. Quigley case involving the state of Washington agreeing to expand community mental health services, this time for kids. And our sister agency in Washington, Disability Rights Washington, worked on that case, and you've got a link to that settlement. We also have information about another Olmstead case. If we have time at the end, I wanted to mention where the New Jersey court has rejected using Olmstead sort of in reverse, which allows the people there were trying to use Olmstead to say that institutions should be able to stay open under Olmstead, and that has been rejected. If we have time, I can go into more detail on that case. The second issue we want to talk about in the second case involves emergency preparedness. There are actually two cases that came down in 2013 that are really significant, and when you talk about the ADA and emergency preparedness, it's not necessarily things that you would maybe necessarily think of, but as a result of the two cases decided in 2013, this has now become, I think, a really significant ADA issue for state and local governments to consider. So the first one is this Brooklyn Center for Independence versus Bloomberg case in New York, and it was filed after Hurricane Irene had hit New York, and there were allegations that New York City had failed to plan for the needs of people with disabilities in large-scale disaster. And the plaintiffs moved for class certification, which was granted. About 900,000 people with disabilities were covered by the class, and right about that same time, Hurricane Sandy hit, and so these issues were very prominent in New York. There was a trial in March, and a great deal of testimony. We've given an example of one person's testimony, a class member who said that she was unable to use an oxygen machine despite informing the utility provider of her reliance on electricity when the storm had hit, and her health had deteriorated, leading her to require emergency attention for oxygen deprivation. So New York had been on notice and had failed to act, was the testimony. Department of Justice got involved in this case by filing a statement of interest, and in November of last year, the court issued a ruling that New York had violated the ADA by having an inadequate emergency preparedness plan. And this is the first opinion that we've ever seen post-trial, after trial, giving the government's emergency finding that the government's emergency preparedness plan violated the Americans with Disabilities Act as well as the Rehabilitation Act. And it wasn't that New York didn't have a plan for people for emergencies. The court actually said it was impressive that it did have some disability components to it. However, there were a lot of holes in the plan that really impacted people with disabilities, and the court found that that was actually benign neglect, and under the ADA you don't have to show malice or intentional discrimination. The fact that you failed to address some needs can be enough. Some of the things they talked about was that there was no system for mass evacuation of people with disabilities from high-rise buildings. The city had said, you know, we can handle those kind of issues on a case-by-case basis, and the court said, wrong. Ad hoc accommodations are both legally inadequate, and they're practically unrealistic. You really need to have advanced planning when it comes to people with disabilities rather than trying to figure this stuff out on the fly. They also said that New York lacked a reliable and effective communication system. They said they were unaware that whether the emergency shelters were accessible. there was no protocol to address needs of people with disabilities in power outages, and they also said that New York was relying on a largely inaccessible public transit system for the evacuations, which would obviously not be an option for many people with disabilities. Interestingly, the court didn't offer a remedy at this point. What they said was they wanted the parties to confer with each other and with the Department of Justice, since they had filed this statement of interest, and see if they can reach an agreement. And if the parties can't reach an agreement, the court will get involved and possibly even have a second trial. So this is something that we may be talking about in our webinar next year as to what the final remedy is. And interestingly, the court did note that the defendants could still raise the undue burden fundamental alteration defense at the remedy stage if some of the accommodations sought by the plaintiffs were deemed to fundamentally alter the system. So that defense is still alive for the defendants, but hopefully they'll be able to reach an agreement that will help put together a good plan for people with disabilities. And sort of a companion case is a case out of California brought on behalf of Communities Actively Living Free and Independent, CALIF, against the City of Los Angeles, and has a lot of similar types of allegations of failing to meet the needs of people with disabilities and planning for disasters. In that case, the court approved a class action settlement in June and agreed to retain jurisdiction for 6 years to make sure that it is enforced. And there's a link at the bottom of the page here that'll give you information about that. I think looking at these cases, especially the New York case, is very detailed in the issues that arise for people with disabilities. I found it really interesting. So if this is an area that you work on or that you're interested in, I would definitely recommend reading all of these cases, but particularly the New York case because of the detailed analysis it does with respect to the needs of people with disabilities in emergency situations. And just want to note that Disability Rights Advocates was co-counsel in both of these cases, so have done great work in this area. And then the last case I'm going to talk about before I turn it over to Rachel is another Title II issue involving the right to vote privately and independently. Another case brought by Disability Rights Advocates. They had quite a year last year. This is California Council of the Blind versus City of Alameda, and it was brought by the group California Council, as well as five blind individuals. And you might remember that after the 2000 election, with all the different problems we had with hanging chads and everything like that, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act to address a lot of voting issues. Well, in addition to the issues that got a lot of press, Congress also included some provisions regarding disability, including a provision that required all polling places to have at least one accessible voting machine. And the machines had to have an audio ballot feature that reads aloud instructions and voting options, and has to have a working tactile keyboard and headphones so voters who are blind can submit a ballot privately and independently. So what happened here was the folks in California found that during the last two elections, the county had failed to ensure that accessible voting machines could be activated and operated by poll workers. And because of these problems, voters who were blind were forced to rely upon third parties to vote, have them fill out their ballot because they could not do so independently because of the broken down equipment. So the plaintiffs argued that the county had to take affirmative steps to make sure that the voting machines were fully operational, the accessible voting machines were fully operational. And they cited a lot of things they thought the county should have done, like providing adequate training of poll workers, conducting adequate testing of each machine, providing timely and skilled technical support services, deploying replacement machines in a timely manner, investigating non-functioning machines to determine the cause, and identifying and implementing solutions to such problems. And the county failed to do this, and as a result, many people, again, as I said before, had to rely upon third parties. Interestingly, the defendant didn't necessarily say that they didn't agree with all those problems, but what they raised legally was they said, no, the ADA right here is the right to vote, not the right to vote independently and privately. And that since people were able to vote, they weren't denied that service, and therefore there was no ADA violation. The plaintiff said the service is not just the right to vote, it's to vote privately and independently. Now remember, when the ADA was passed, it referenced voting in the preamble regarding the history of discrimination against people with disabilities, but if you look at the ADA, there's actually no reference to voting privately and independently, and the DOJ regulations don't reference voting at all. So there's nothing really to hang your hat on this private and independent in the ADA itself. However, the court found that the plaintiff's claims could move forward and found that the county here did not provide meaningful access to private and independent voting. They found that voting is a service of a municipality, and one of the central features of voting is to vote, not only be able to vote, but to vote privately and independently, just like everyone else. And that's an equal opportunity that these plaintiffs have been denied. And they also said that the ADA talks about having working auxiliary aids and services to allow people the opportunity to participate and protect people's privacy and independence. So even though the regulations don't talk about privacy and independence with respect to voting, those terms are used generally with respect to auxiliary aids. The court sort of said, look, we know we're going out on a limb here. We know there's other courts that have not necessarily recognized this private and independent right to voting, but we believe it's necessary. And that with the changing times, as technology progresses, there weren't accessible voting machines in 1990 when the ADA was passed. So the fact that it's not in the ADA shouldn't preclude the fact of it applying to the ADA. And they focused on the fact that the meaningful access language in the DOJ really showed, if you applied that here, the plaintiffs here did not have meaningful access because they could not vote like everybody else. And they also rejected the defendant's argument that the fact there was no independent right under the Help America Vote Act didn't give the transfer of this independent and privacy option in HAVA over to the ADA. They said you can't sort of bring that over to the ADA since there is no private right of action under the Help America Vote Act. And the court said, those are apples and oranges. HAVA provides a standard that then the ADA can apply in its enforcement of discrimination. So ultimately, the court found that the plaintiffs were successful here. They also cited Title II's maintenance requirement. It means that you have to maintain auxiliary aids and services. You can't just have the equipment, but you have to actually maintain it. It'd be like having a bus lift that's broken all the time. That's not enough. You have to maintain the equipment. So as a result, the plaintiffs were successful here. And that leads us to the Title III cases. And Rachel.
Thanks, Barry. So there are three Title III cases that we wanted to highlight today. The first is Argeni versus Creighton University, which is a case about effective communication in higher education. The plaintiff, Michael Argeni, is deaf, and he doesn't know American Sign Language, but instead he uses cued speech interpreters and CART, Communication Access Real-Time Translation, to communicate. And for his undergraduate, he attended Seattle University, and with the use of CART and cued speech interpreters, he did really well. He graduated with a 3.87 grade point average. So he ended up applying to medical school at Creighton and disclosed his disability. And once he was accepted, he requested a couple different types of accommodations. He requested CART, which again is that Communication Access Real-Time Translation, for his lectures. He requested cued speech interpreters for his labs. And he requested an FM system for his small group learning. And he supported all of these requests with medical documentation. However, Creighton University denied Michael's requests for CART and for interpreters and instead only offered an FM system. And Michael tried to use this FM system for a while, but ultimately found that it caused him a lot of stress and a lot of fatigue, and he was really missing a lot of information. So he renewed his request for accommodations and explained, this FM system wasn't working for him, he wasn't able to participate. Unfortunately, however, Creighton continued to deny Michael's request, although it did offer him some enhanced note-taking services. It still wasn't enough for Michael, and so in 2009, he brought this lawsuit, but he continued to stay in school. He brought this case under Title III of the ADA because Creighton University is a private college, and he also brought it under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act because Creighton receives federal funding. So during this lawsuit, Michael actually consulted with an expert who determined that the FM system he was using, and even with the FM system, he only had 38% speech perception. And so he really, without this CART and without the cued speech interpreters, wasn't getting a lot of information, was missing a lot of the material. So Michael finished his first year, he passed, he started his second year, he renewed his request for accommodations. And at this time, Creighton changed their tune a little bit. They decided to provide him with the cued speech interpreter for his lectures, although if you remember, he requested CART captioning for his lectures. And again, Michael, you know, trying to be a good sport, tried the interpreter, but he found that due to the medical school's complex new vocabulary, he really still couldn't understand. So he decided, you know what, he's in school, he needs to do this, and so he ended up taking out additional money, and he funded his own CART captioning. And ultimately, during these first 2 years of Michael's schooling, he borrowed over $100,000 to fund his own accommodations. But then, in his second year, Michael started to take clinical classes, and he ran into another problem, and that is Creighton refused to allow him to use an interpreter, even if he paid for it himself. And so after his first and his second year of medical school, Michael opted to take a leave of absence, as he believed he really wasn't going to be successful without an interpreter, and he continued to pursue this lawsuit. And at first, things weren't looking so good. The district court found for Creighton University, granted summary judgment for them. And when Michael was opposing Creighton's motion for summary judgment, he provided an affidavit which discussed his disability and his need for accommodations. And the district court actually disregarded the facts in Michael's affidavit and said that it was self-serving and found that it was unsupported by the other evidence in the case. And the district court ultimately concluded that the accommodations that Michael requested were not necessary because he was capable of attending and passing class without him. So Michael appealed this decision to the Eighth Circuit, and so much happened in this Argeni case in 2013, but the first of the important things that happened was that the Eighth Circuit reversed and remanded the district court's decision. We'll discuss this a little bit in more detail, but the Eighth Circuit concluded that the district court had made both factual errors and legal errors. And we just wanted to highlight that there are a number of amicus briefs filed in support of Michael's position, including one from the Department of Justice and one from NDRN, the National Disability Rights Network. And we have a link to the DOJ brief on this slide. So starting with the Eighth Circuit's assessment of the facts, it held that the district court erred when it disregarded Michael's affidavit and found no other evidence to support his claim. So this is important as a general legal matter because, you know, affidavits by their very nature are self-serving. But we think this is especially important for what it means to people with disabilities and the value that's placed on their own description of their disability and on their accommodation needs. And the Eighth Circuit actually cited the Department of Justice's Technical Assistance Manual and concluded, and I quote, "In a case such as this, it is especially important to consider the complainant's testimony carefully because the individual with a disability is most familiar with his or her disability and is in the best position to determine what type of aid or service will be effective." Deferring to an individual's preference is something that the DOJ has always recommended, but it was important to see that an appellate court decision actually using this language to show the value of a plaintiff's own testimony. So looking at Michael's affidavit, the Eighth Circuit noted that without the accommodations he needed, Michael was unable to follow class lectures and dialogue, he couldn't communicate with patients in clinical settings, and he also experienced headaches and debilitating fatigue due to the FM system. And the Eighth Circuit also acknowledged that Michael did provide the medical documentation supporting his accommodation needs. So moving on to the Eighth Circuit's assessment of the law. Under the ADA, colleges and universities need to provide necessary auxiliary aids and services. So the question that was that the question that the Eighth Circuit had to answer was, well, what does this mean? The district court suggested that to be necessary, the auxiliary to mean that without the auxiliary aids, the individual was effectively excluded from participation. But the Eighth Circuit said that this standard is incorrect. Instead, the proper standard is a meaningful access standard. That is, to provide meaningful access, auxiliary aids and services must be furnished so that all individuals have an equal opportunity to gain a like or equal benefit. And applying that standard, the Eighth Circuit found that here there is a triable question as to whether Creighton denied Michael an equal opportunity to gain an equal benefit as to his medical school peers when it refused to provide him with the accommodations. So this is a really important appellate court decision because it establishes this proper standard for assessing requests for auxiliary aids and services. This case was brought by Equip for Equality sister agency, Disability Rights Nebraska, and so we have a link to their website on the bottom of the slide with some more information. But of course, after the Eighth Circuit decided this case, it remanded it back down to the trial court, and so in 2013 also saw a jury trial in the Argeni case. In August of 2013, the jury found for Michael, and specifically found that Creighton discriminated against Michael in violation of the ADA and the Rehab Act, and importantly, they found that providing the auxiliary aids and services would not have caused Creighton an undue burden, which is an important conclusion given that there would have been a substantial cost for providing these services. However, the court found that Creighton's actions were not intentional and that Creighton didn't act with deliberate indifference, and so Creighton was not responsible for paying compensatory damages under the Rehab Act. So after that jury decision, there was another decision that had to be made, and that was that the judge had to decide whether to issue injunctive relief, whether Creighton would have had to accommodate Michael in his final 2 years of medical school, and had to decide a question of equitable relief, and that was whether to reimburse Michael for the cost of the past accommodations. And 2013 also saw that decision, and that happened just about a month ago on December 19th. The court issued its opinion, and it did order Creighton University to provide Michael with auxiliary aids and services for his effective communication needs moving forward, including CART in lectures and oral interpreters in small group settings. However, the court denied Michael's request for equitable relief and said that this was really akin to the compensatory damages that the jury had already said wasn't appropriate in this case. So as you can see, it's been a really busy year for the Argeni case, which has really important implications for other institutions of higher education and for individuals requesting auxiliary aids and services for effective communication. And really quickly, I just wanted to mention this companion case that we've got noted on slide 61, which is also a recent Ninth Circuit court decision, KM versus Tustin Unified School District. And that case, in that case, held that a school district can be liable for failing to provide effective communication under Title II, even if it complied with another federal law, which is the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, or IDEA. And the court explained that these laws have different requirements. So citing the Argeni case, this Ninth Circuit emphasized this meaningful access standard. So both, you know, two very interesting cases about the issue of effective communication for those who are interested in that issue. And while we're on the topic of cases relating to colleges and universities, we wanted to quickly highlight three settlement agreements from 2013. And actually, I know we're in the Title III section here, but these cases are technically under Title II because they're all public colleges, but we thought that they would be a nice follow-up to the Argeni case. And we included links for those who are interested in learning more, but we just wanted to highlight that three colleges, Louisiana Tech, South Carolina Technical College, and UC Berkeley, entered into agreements this year to make their course material and websites accessible. And interestingly, each of these agreements came about in different ways, as they were agreements that were made with the Department of Justice, with the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, and the final one, the UC Berkeley agreement, was made through structured negotiations with disability rights advocates. So links to all of these agreements are found on the slide for those interested in learning more. One issue that we discuss regularly when we're talking about Title III is that of standing. And our next case, Share versus Marriott International, addresses both standing and the continuing violation doctrine. In Share, the plaintiff was an elderly woman with a neurodegenerative disorder who uses a walker for mobility. She lives in Illinois, but she traveled to Overland Park, Kansas in 2006. And during this visit, she stayed at the Marriott and booked an accessible room. Now, during the plaintiff regularly visits Overland Park, as she has a number of relatives who live in the area. So this lawsuit came about because in 2004, Marriott had renovated about 50 or over 50 of its hotels, including the one in Overland Park, and installed a spring hinge door closer on bathroom doors of its accessible rooms. And so during her stay, the bathroom door actually hit the plaintiff, caused her to fall and break her wrist and injure her hip. So shortly after her stay, she filed a negligence claim, which she settled. And then 4 years later, she filed an ADA lawsuit. Marriott moved to dismiss this lawsuit and alleged three things. Number one, that the plaintiff's claim was barred by the statute of limitations, because remember, the plaintiff filed this lawsuit 4 years after encountering the barrier, and the relevant statute of limitations in Illinois is 2 years. Two, that the plaintiff lacked standing, and three, that it was substantively in compliance with the technical standards. So the first legally significant issue in this case is the issue of statute of limitations. And again, the question is, when does a plaintiff need to file an ADA lawsuit when she's alleging an ongoing architectural violation? And I'm not going to get into the details of all these cases, but the case law out there is mixed. There's not a clear rule as to when the claim accrues and when someone needs to file an ADA lawsuit. But what happened in this case is that the district court and the Seventh Circuit applied a concept that's been referred to as a continuing violation doctrine, which enables a plaintiff to bring a claim despite the running of a statute of limitations because the alleged architectural violation still exists. And here the Seventh Circuit came to this decision because it looked at the ADA's language and said, okay, well, injunctive relief's available to an individual who is being subjected to discrimination, but it's also available to someone who's about to be subjected to discrimination. And so because of that language, it has to consider a continuing threat or violation of an ADA, of the ADA to be an injury. And so basically this court continued on with a set of cases saying that a statute of limitations cannot bar a plaintiff from bringing a claim challenging an architectural violation of the ADA if the barrier continues to exist. This is an important decision because there's been so many cases out there finding different things. There's not necessarily a clear circuit split because a lot of the laws differ. Some are under Title II, some are under Title III, some are under the Fair Housing Act. But perhaps if there's more cases like this, it's a question that ultimately will find its way to the Supreme Court. So the second legally significant question in SHARE is the question of standing. And as a very, very quick refresher, under Article 3 of the Constitution, plaintiffs need to have standing to bring a lawsuit, which means, among other things, they need to establish an injury in fact. And that means that they need to show that there's a real and immediate threat of future injury to their rights. And here, the district court and the Seventh Circuit found that SHARE had standing to sue the Marriott in Overland Park, but not any of the other 56 hotels that had allegedly problematic door closers. So the court said that SHARE had standing to sue the Overland Park Marriott because she established a real and immediate threat of a future violation, because she was going to return, she had showed that she would return to the hotel but for the accessibility problems, and she had reason to do this because she had 29 relatives there. And the court found that this was enough to show a real and immediate threat that the plaintiff would suffer future harm. But it found that the plaintiff did not have standing to sue the other 56 hotels. You know, although the plaintiff wasn't required to actually visit each of these hotels to assess the accessibility, she did need to show an intent to return to that place. And here, she never said that she was going to return to any of these specific Marriotts, or even said that she was going to return to the general geographic areas where these Marriotts were located. So our advice for plaintiffs out there in Title III cases is it's really important to be very specific about your intent to return. And we just wanted to note, it's for some technical reasons, the plaintiff ultimately ended up losing the merits of her claim. And once the decision was decided, the court found that the specific door in question was actually not a violation of the ADA. But this case is still a very important one because of the legally significant decisions with respect to the continuing violation doctrine and withstanding. And while we're on the topic of standing, we wanted to note another standing case, which is a Ninth Circuit case, Houston versus Merritt Supermarkets. And this case asks whether testers have standing. Testers are individuals who are specifically trying to assess compliance with the civil rights law. And in this case, Houston filed a lawsuit against a supermarket alleging that the supermarket violated various parts of the ADA because its parking, PAPA travel, and restrooms were inaccessible. There's a number of things we know about the plaintiff, but the most important ones are the fact that the plaintiff did not live close to the supermarket, lived over 30 miles away, but it had visited the supermarket a couple times in the past. And importantly, the plaintiff said that he was intending to return to the supermarket both to shop, but one of his real motivations was to actually assess the ADA compliance. This individual also was party to or part of an advocacy group that was party to about 271 ADA lawsuits, and the supermarket was actually close to the plaintiff, his plaintiff attorney's office. And so at the district court level, the court found that this plaintiff did not have standing. And the reason why is that because this plaintiff was a tester of ADA compliance, the court found that he was not a bona fide patron of the supermarket, and that the fact that the plaintiff lived 30 miles away diminished the likelihood that the individual would actually return to the supermarket. And so there wasn't enough to warrant standing. So on appeal, the court asked whether the plaintiff, whether testers in general can have standing, and if so, whether this particular tester had standing. So starting with the first question, which is the more legally significant of the two, the 11th Circuit found that yes, testers can have standing under certain parts of Title III. What the 11th Circuit did is it looked to the ADA's language, and the ADA had some pretty broad terms. It said the ADA says no individual shall be discriminated against in attending places of public accommodation. So that word no individual is a broad one and doesn't have any, there's no suggestion that that would exclude a tester. It also looked to the remedy language of remedies under the ADA, which says that any person who's being subjected to discrimination may bring suit. Again, any person, this is pretty broad language. And the Supreme Court also looked to the 11th Circuit also looked to a Supreme Court case and analyzed this to the Fair Housing Act, which said that in some cases under the Fair Housing Act, when they used that same broad language, any person, that was found to permit tester standing. And on the other side of the coin, in addition to the broad language, the 11th Circuit said, look, Congress knows how to limit statutes when it wants to. In both other parts of the ADA and other parts of the Fair Housing Act, there's actually specific language in there requiring a bona fide status. And so Congress knows how to limit laws if it wants to. But in this particular case, the language is really broad, and so there's no reason to limit standing, and testers can have standing. So then the next question was, okay, well, if testers generally can have standing, does this particular tester have standing? And again, the court found that yes, this particular tester has standing. It looked to the fact that he had visited this supermarket twice in the past and had even returned after encountering a barrier. And what's interesting is it said despite the distance, the plaintiff was able to explain his reason to return. He was planning to return to this geographic area because that's where his lawyer's office was located, and he had so many ADA lawsuits. And because there's no evidence that the architectural problems have been fixed, there's a 100% likelihood that the plaintiff will suffer an alleged injury when he returns. So one thing about this case that I think is particularly interesting is the fact that the defendant tried to use the plaintiff's many lawsuits against him to show that he did not have standing, but ultimately the fact that the plaintiff had so many lawsuits and had a reason to visit this geographic area was what actually saved his personal standing argument. So, you never really know how facts are going to play out in a case. However, the court did caution that the standing inquiry is a very fact-sensitive inquiry, but here the plaintiff did have standing. So with that, we've got a couple of minutes left. Barry, do you want to do the updates or turn to questions?
I think what we should do is probably just do a quick update, and then if folks have questions that we haven't gotten to, we can look at those and work with Great Lakes on responding to those, and people can also shoot us an email. So we had three cases that had some updates. One, if you remember, is a case involving an employer with respect to reasonable accommodations of moving into another position or reassignment. And last year we told you that the Seventh Circuit joined the majority of circuits and held that reassignment to a vacant position without competition was a reasonable accommodation under the ADA unless you could show undue hardship or a seniority system. And because the Supreme Court had previously looked at this issue in a case, but then that case settled so they couldn't resolve it, we said maybe let's watch this next year and see if the Supreme Court takes this case because they've expressed interest in this issue before. And our update this year is that the Supreme Court did deny the request for review. United Airlines did ask the Supreme Court to review it, but they denied. So we still have a split in that the Eighth Circuit says that you have to compete for the position, but all the other circuit courts are saying you don't have to compete. You should be placed in that position if you're qualified to do it, and it wouldn't be an undue hardship.
Okay, last year we also talked about the EEOC versus Henry's Turkey Service case, which is a case that got a lot of press because of really the very extreme and terrible circumstances. But very quickly, the EEOC had brought a lawsuit on behalf of 32 individuals with intellectual disabilities who had basically been working in a sheltered workshop and had been housed in bunkers with really deplorable working conditions, had been harassed, and had received just pennies as for their, they received, I think it was $65 a month, so sub-minimum wages. In 2012, which is what we talked about last year, the court had actually awarded summary judgment to the plaintiffs and awarded $1.3 million. And so we discuss this case because that is a very large amount of money to be given to plaintiffs on a summary judgment motion. And we said stay tuned for a trial. And there was a trial, and there was a jury verdict for $240 million, which was made up of it was made up of a lot of punitive damages and compensatory damages. And this was the largest award in EEOC history. So it got a lot of publicity. And then shortly after that award came down, the parties actually agreed to a lesser amount. And the reason for that is that the ADA imposes statutory caps on compensatory and punitive damages. And those caps vary based on the size of the employer. And so Henry's Turkey Farm was a small employer, and so they were capped at receiving $50,000 or paying $50,000 per individual. And so because of that, even though the jury had awarded $240 million in damages, that amount was going to be reduced by the court, and so the parties ended up agreeing to that lesser amount of $1.6 million. So a lot happened in that case this year. And then the final update we wanted to give is a case in the New York City taxicab case that has been happening for a while. And so last year we talked about the fact that the Second Circuit found that New York City's regulation of taxicabs to fall outside the scope of Title II. The plaintiffs had alleged that taxicabs needed to be accessible and that New York City wasn't regulating them in a way to ensure that they were accessible. But this year, what happened in April is that the plaintiffs asked the court if they could amend their complaint to include different factual challenges. And specifically, the plaintiffs said, you know, court, New York City has selected the Nissan NV200 van to be the exclusive taxi vehicle for the next decade, and this van is not accessible. And so now, you know, New York City is more is having direct control over the options for the accessibility of New York cabs, and so this is what we want our lawsuit to be about. And shortly after the court permitted the plaintiffs to amend their complaint, the parties announced a settlement. And this was another case brought by disability rights advocates, so you can get some more information here. But the settlements, there's currently a memorandum of understanding, and that is that New York City is going to try to promulgate some rules, and the rules will phase in accessible vehicles such that by 2020, 50% of the taxi cab fleet in New York City will be wheelchair accessible. That case isn't totally over yet because the court's going to continue to monitor this whole rulemaking process. But you know, there's been a very large step in the direction of towards settlement, and we'll just continue to monitor to see how it all plays out.
Great, thanks, Rachel. So just a reminder that if you're an Illinois attorney and you want continuing legal education credit for today's webinar, just email me at barryt@equipforequality.org. We will be working with Great Lakes to follow up on the questions we didn't get to. And we just want to remind you that our next session will be in May 21st, and we are, as we referenced before, going to be talking about qualified under the ADA, the new legal battleground after the ADA Amendments Act. You will be getting a session evaluation, so please give us your feedback as to how this went for you, if there are any issues that we can address in the future, or any topics you'd like us to address in the future. You'll get an email following the session with a link to the online evaluation. And with that, Jessica, any final comments?
Thank you both very much. Another great session for part of this series. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. The session is being archived and will be available on the ADA Online Learning website in the next 24 hours. And that concludes things for today. To exit the webinar room, please click on the red X in the top right corner of your browser. And we hope to see you at our next session. Thanks, everyone. Have a great afternoon.